This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show talking about something that many of you have probably done, some of you are maybe thinking about doing, and we're going to talk about it. That's genetic ancestry testing. And we're going to talk about it with Wendy Roth. She's an associate professor of sociology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She's also a faculty associate at the Peter Wall Institute for Advanced Studies. And she's in Fargo-Moorhead today to give the annual community lecture for the College of Science and Mathematics at NDSU with the provocative title, The Social Impact of Genetic Ancestry Testing. Wendy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
How accurate is genetic ancestry testing?
Ah, well, that's a great question. The tests themselves, it's not that they're not accurate. They are accurate, but they've got a lot of limitations. And so they're accurate at what they can do, but people misinterpret them and think that they do a lot more than they actually do. So a lot of the times people will see these genetic ancestry tests and they'll see a pie chart, right? The pie chart tells them that they are 57% Scottish and 12% German or something else. And so they think that that means that 57% of their DNA is Scottish. That's not what it means. The tests are only looking at a tiny, tiny fraction of your DNA. And within that, they're telling you about a probability that a certain number of markers are more often associated with Scottish than with other things.
So they're marketed as telling you what your ancestry is. I mean, that's why I sent my money in, and lots of millions and millions of other people have as well. So I'm not such and such Scottish, such and such Irish, such and such English.
I think the way to think about it is as a probability. You know, there's a good probability that you are Scottish, German, whatever the test tells you. But it wouldn't be accurate to think of it as definitive. It's not saying that this is absolutely what you are. And anyone who's taken these tests and then gone back on a couple of months later to check again and see that their estimates have changed somewhat knows that it's not telling you something absolute. It's giving you a general idea that's meant to be supplemented with archival or historical research.
How does this kind of DNA testing, this genetic ancestry testing, compare with what would happen in a crime lab with DNA testing?
It's a similar kind of process. It's looking at something a little bit different, though, within the DNA. It's looking at particular markers, so particular genetic markers that scientists have found are generally good at differentiating different populations that they're trying to separate. So they might be trying to find a marker that's good at separating Scandinavians from Southern Europeans. And the markers are sort of able to tell them that within a margin of error. That's not what they do when they're looking in a forensic lab. There, they have one sample from one individual, and they're trying to match that precisely to another sample that they might find in a database.
Sort of like testing that bullet and whether it matches the same gun.
Yes, okay. More like that.
Well, genetic this and that. We're talking about genetic ancestry testing. We just talked about forensic crime genetic testing. How about genetic testing for a predisposition for genetic disorders or problems?
Yeah. So that is something that I actually don't focus on so much in my research. But there too, when testing companies where you send something in and get a result back are telling you about a genetic predisposition or a risk of developing a certain health problem, for instance, again, they're telling you a probability. So there's a very good chance that you could have a marker that has a higher probability or several markers that have a higher probability for you developing Alzheimer's, and you still never develop Alzheimer's.
Wendy Roth is the associate professor of sociology at the University of British Columbia. She's in Fargo-Moorhead for the annual community lecture. That's 7 p.m. this evening at the Fargo Theater. It's free and open to the public, and the title is The Social Impact of Genetic Ancestry Testing. Have you had the test, Wendy?
I have. I decided that if I was going to ask other people to take the test, I should experience it myself too.
And were you surprised by the results?
Not very. So before I took it, I wrote down my predictions, what I thought that I would find. My family is Jewish, and I didn't know of any ancestor that wasn't Jewish, so I thought that's pretty much what I'm going to find. But I expected that over time there must have been some outmarriage. So I wrote down 95% Jewish, and that is exactly what I found, 95%. The remaining 5% initially said 4% Eastern European, which is not really a surprise, and 1% Scandinavian. So at first I thought, okay, you know, that's kind of interesting. I didn't expect that. But a couple of months later, I checked back again, and that was gone. So when you do find those very small percentages like that, don't put too much stock in them.
So as part of that, just the fact that the test might be variable in terms of the way it's being sampled, or is it the sample size has changed and the test is evolving as the sample size changes?
Yeah, that's right. So the sample size is changing because the sample is made up of all the customers in the company. So as more people buy the tests, there's an increasing sample size. And sometimes they might also supplement the sample with some academic research samples or populations of particular groups that were underrepresented. They might go out and get some DNA samples from people in different parts of the world. But the sample is always changing. So the estimates are always changing too.
Al, let's get to the nut of this here. In a nutshell, what is the social impact of genetic ancestry testing?
Okay. Well, so I am a sociologist. I focus on race and ethnicity. And so I'm really interested in how these tests affect people's racial and ethnic identities and also how they influence the way that people think about what race is. So do we think of race as something genetic, genetically determined, or do we think of it as something that societies create? And I'm also interested in some other things that, focus on, how do these things change our attitudes towards other racial and ethnic groups? If we find out that we've got a certain ancestry we never knew about, do we reach out to those people and become friends with people we didn't know about before, or become more accepting of those groups? So what I'm going to talk about today in the community lecture is the impact on identity and on conceptions about the nature of race. And what I basically find with regard to identity is that not as many people are influenced by the test results as you might expect, but of those who are, people really tend to pick and choose which aspects of their results they want to identify with. And they tend to pick the groups that they like, they respect, or that they see positively in some way, and they'll identify with those groups. But any group they find out about that they don't like or they're biased against, they just disregard that part. And they also focus on what they think other people will accept. So if I claim to be African American, is anybody going to accept that when I say it? And if not, then I won't make that claim. So people tend to think that, oh, these tests are genetic, it's definitive, it's deterministic. But actually, people are really allowing their social interests and considerations to come into play when they decide how they're going to react to these tests.
So I get the results of my test and I embrace this piece of it and I say, well, I'm lucky I survived that one, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
Well, how does a sociologist define race?
Great question. So I define race as a group that either is seen by others or sees itself as distinct because there are certain biological characteristics that societies refer to and say these things make up a race, a group. So it could be your skin color. It could be your height. It could be your hair texture. But with all of these things, it's societies referring to those characteristics and saying, ah, that make somebody part of this racial group. It's not that there's something in the genes or our biology that is an indicator or definitively says you are in this category. There's actually no biological markers that can find or identify someone's race. Rather, people and societies are saying, I see that characteristic and that to me signals that this person should be part of this group. And what's interesting is that different societies do that differently. So it's not universal, and it's not just inherent. It's all about how we as a society decide that people should be grouped.
And how would you contrast the concept of race with the idea of ethnicity?
Ethnicity, I think of as a group that has a shared historical experience, shared memories, aspects of a culture. So it's much more about what you experience. If you were adopted into a group and raised with that group your entire life, you might say that that group is your ethnicity, even if you don't have a genetic inheritance from members of that group.
Now, there have been millions, tens of millions of these tests taken now. And so there's this huge database out there. Before we delve into the issues of a database like that, what have sociologists learned so far from the huge number of genetic samples that have been taken?
Well, there actually aren't that many sociologists who are looking at these large genetic samples.
How about Wendy Roth?
So what I am doing is I'm talking to people who've taken the tests. I'm not actually looking at the genetic databases themselves.
Uh-huh.
Although I do get the people who I interview to share with me their specific test results. But an important thing to know is that every testing company has its own database, and they don't share them. Each one is proprietary.
Wow.
So if you test with a different company, you could get a different result.
Well, that is interesting because we have a number of major companies, Veritas, Genetics, Ancestry, and 23andMe are out there. They're advertising and trying to get attention for themselves. And they've got this database. And my question is, what's the product? What they're sending me, my information about my ancestry, or what I sent them?
That's a very good question. You know, some of the companies, 23andMe, for example, does actually ask people if they're willing to allow their DNA to be used in research. And then they will take the genetic samples from the people who say yes, and they will conduct research on it. But they also will share it with pharmaceutical companies, or they will allow others to do research on their database. They will allow other companies to come in and do research on it. So in some ways, the DNA we give them is the product. If we get something useful out of it, you could say that, you know, that's a product for us as well. But increasingly, I think that many of the companies see what we are giving them as of greater value than what they are giving us.
So how good is a company's privacy statement?
Well, so that is certainly an issue. And the truth is that with so many of the privacy statements that we get these days, most people don't read them very thoroughly.
And they're updated occasionally.
That's right.
Changed.
And we don't go back and check them all the time either. So some of the testing companies do cooperate with the police, for example, if the police have an interest in searching through their database to find a particular DNA sample within it. Some companies will work with them. Others say, no, we need to be subpoenaed for that to happen. But in any case, if a subpoena comes, they have to cooperate with that, of course. Now, the companies that do make their databases available to academic researchers or companies or pharmaceuticals, there the privacy says that once you donate your DNA, well, really in all cases, once you donate your DNA, you no longer have any ability to control it. And let's think for a minute about what that means, because that means that it's not just my DNA that I am giving up and handing over my rights to, my privacy over. It's also my brothers, my sisters, my parents, all of the people who are related to me who never consented to this, but they can be identified through my DNA.
Now, you said something that intrigued me there. You said law enforcement might be able to go back to a company that does ancestric DNA testing and say, who is this person? Because you always think of it, well, isn't it anonymous once it gets there? Well, obviously it's not. It came in an addressed envelope from me to them. And at some point, there's a record of that sample. So, wow.
Yeah. So if there were a subpoena, the police could say, we need you to identify who person number 12345 is so that they could interview you and find out which of your relatives might have been in this crime scene at the time the crime was committed.
And, of course, there is hacking. I guess the question I'd have in my head is, why would you want to hack a genetic ancestry testing organization? But then I imagine somebody's imagination has figured out a reason.
Yes. I'm not sure yet exactly what that reason might be, but I can imagine that it must be crossing someone's mind.
Well, there is the potential, as we mentioned, the various kinds of genetic testing, ancestry being one and health being another and forensic being one. So isn't there the possibility someday that whatever genetic predisposition we might show for a behavioral issue or a physical health issue might come under scrutiny?
It's certainly a possibility. There's been a lot of concern that insurance companies might be able to access this information and might say that they refuse to insure somebody who has the genes that suggest a higher risk of developing Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or some particular health problem. At the moment, that is not something that insurance companies have been able to access, but we don't know where things might go in the future.
Well, this is all important, and it's like the horse is already out of the barn here in a way, because here you are, you're teaching at the University of British Columbia, and you're speaking at the NDSU annual community lecture this evening in downtown Fargo. Is this something that should be incorporated immediately in the curriculum of higher education?
I think it would be a very valuable thing if higher education made more of an emphasis to try to help people understand what your genes can and can't tell you with regard to health risks, with regard to ancestry. And even though not everyone is going to take these tests, basically helping them understand what these tests say and what they can't say. One of the problems that I've found in my research is that many of the people who take these tests don't necessarily have enough of an understanding of genetics to really be able to put them in context. The people who do put these tests in context because they are more knowledgeable about genetics, taking these tests actually reduces their belief that races are essential biologically different groups. But people who have less or almost no understanding of genetics on the scale that I measured it on, there's an indication that it actually increases essentialist beliefs for them, this belief that races are genetically different at their core and maybe differ in their skills and abilities. And that's a view that's really concerning, because that view that races are biologically different often turns into the idea that races are biologically inferior to others. And that's been used to justify genocide, oppression, so many forms of racism. So that's something we should be very concerned about. And higher education should recognize that there are a lot of people out there taking these tests. There are also a lot of people out there who are going to have access to their personal genome in the future, and they need to know what to do with that information.
What about government regulation and oversight here? Is this something that is lacking?
There has been some discussion about whether there should be government regulation and oversight of this industry. And there has been a little bit. Some states for a while would not sell genetic ancestry tests. There was also FDA oversight of 23andMe for a while that actually asked them to stop selling their health-related tests, although not their ancestry-related tests, because they felt that the assurances that they were giving people were not backed up effectively by the science. So there's a little bit, but there isn't necessarily the extent of oversight that some people would like to see. And whether or not that oversight will actually come, I think is really going to come down to whether the public demands it, whether enough people who take these tests and maybe have concerns about their privacy or concerns about insurance companies being able to access this rise up and say, we need some oversight here.
Well, we are so out there now because of the online lives that we lead and all of the digitized data about us that exists everywhere now. When a baby is born, typically a footprint is made of that baby, and it's on the birth certificate or whatever. It's a record of the birth, and it supposedly identifies that child. So is genetic testing going to be part of the birth process? Because there are all kinds of – there's all kinds of material there that offers DNA right at the site.
Yeah. I think that would be very concerning if that were the case, because once again, once that information is known of every person on Earth, who knows what is going to be done with it? I don't know how many of your listeners know the movie Gattaca, which came out a few years ago, but it reminds me very much of that.
And that was genetic testing or genetic identification to the nth degree.
That's right, where basically people who were genetically engineered to be of superior quality were given all kinds of opportunities for jobs and life, and people who were not genetically engineered were basically excluded from those jobs. And although it was a film, I think there's a lot of concern that something like that could happen if every baby were asked or forced to give a DNA sample at birth.
And of course, every country has its own laws. We are not, planet Earth is not one government. So there's a patchwork of laws and regulations and guidelines and oversight all around the world. And you can only speculate whether it's already been done someplace.
Well, that's certainly true. I don't know of any place where this is happening systematically in any country or context, but there have been places where there has been experimenting with genetics in a way that the United States would certainly not allow.
Well, we're talking about the social impact of genetic ancestry testing, and we've been talking about sort of the downsides of it. Let's talk about what's good about it. Mm-hmm. What is good about ancestry testing?
Well, first of all, there is a possibility that somebody who takes one of these tests could be matched with somebody who is a relative. So in addition to
That's happened, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's happened to me.
Wow.
So I took the test and found through the database of the company I tested with my father's first cousin, who he had completely lost contact with. His mother died when he was 2. They lost contact with that side of the family. And so I sort of knew who her brothers were, but I didn't know anything about their descendants. And lo and behold, I found somebody who was the daughter of my grandmother's brother, met her last year for the first time.
Oh.
We've stayed in touch. It's been wonderful. I've been able to see additional photographs of my great uncle, and I've basically developed a connection now with her and her daughters, and so that's a really wonderful thing. For many people who have mysteries in their family, people who are adopted, people who have serious questions about whether the stories their family has told them are correct, DNA tests can be very informative. And sometimes the news is good, sometimes it's not so good, but at the very least, there is this potential to connect with relatives through these tests. And in a similar vein, for people who are interested in tracing their family tree, these tests, if they're used very carefully, can actually provide additional information that helps you narrow down the archival research that you might try to do in your genealogy, especially for people who maybe have hit a brick wall, right? So there are a lot of African Americans who can't trace their family back beyond the slave trade. There are a lot of Jewish families whose records were lost in the Holocaust. There are a lot of people who might have partial descent from Native Americans, but because they weren't on the Dawes roll, they don't have any documentation of that. And so it's a matter of chance. You have to be lucky. But if you're lucky, it may just happen that one of your relatives who holds the key to unlocking a branch of your family might also have taken this test.
Wow. And of course, there's also the possibility, because we talked about the downside of the medical genetic testing, that all of these tests will enable research to actually find better solutions to genetic disorders.
That's certainly a possibility. I don't know if the ancestry tests per se will do that, but certainly the genome, genetic information in general, has huge potential for that.
Well, this is a rich topic, and it's here for the community today because the social impact of genetic ancestry testing is the topic for the annual community lecture organized by the College of Science and Mathematics at North Dakota State University. It is 7 this evening at the Fargo Theater. It's free and open to the public. And Wendy Roth will be talking about this. Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you.
Coming up on Main Street, Bill Thomas will take us to a new art exhibit. But first, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Public Service Commission has approved the siting permit for a new natural gas liquids pipeline in McKenzie County. One Oak plans to build a 77-mile pipeline from its Demix Lake natural gas processing plant to Richland County, Montana, where it will interconnect with another pipeline to take liquids to the southern U.S. 74 of the 77 miles will be in North Dakota. Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk says it's a 20-inch steel pipeline designed to carry 40,000 barrels of NGLs per day. She says the majority of the pipeline will be co-located in an existing pipeline corridor, thereby reducing its environmental footprint.
This is really important critical infrastructure to support the continued production in the Bakken, to reduce flaring, and to transport this energy product as safely as possible in a manner that has the least impact to the people, to the quality of life in the area, and to the environment.
Total cost for the project is $125 million. Farm equipment sales are down nearly $1 billion for the first 3 months of the year, according to the U.S. Commerce Department. It's the biggest drop in 3 years. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports that one of the side effects is a drop-off in farm productivity.
With each model year, combines, tractors, sprayers, and planters come with new technology, ranging from more accurate GPS to faster speeds of planting and harvesting. University of Missouri agricultural economist Pat Westhoff says when farmers defer replacing their equipment like they have so far in 2019, it means they are holding on to old technology.
So that means that we don't make the big advancements in the amount of acreage we can plant per hour and the amount of product we can harvest eventually from those fields.
Westhoff says the eventual end of the Trump administration's tariffs and higher crop prices will likely spur farmers to replace those old machines. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
And tornado sirens will be sounding across North Dakota today as part of Severe Weather Awareness Week.
This is, again, the time of the year when we're just not that far yet from winter. We aren't fully into summer, but severe weather is just around the corner. You know, we can get a warm frontal surge up here any day and start to see big hail, big wind, or even tornadoes. So it's not out of the question.
Greg Gust is a warning coordination meteorologist with the Grand Forks National Weather Service office. He says as things warm up, there will be plenty of beautiful summer days ahead, but things can change quickly.
Just like you can have clear blue and 82 degrees, if we can even imagine what that's like, and not a cloud in the sky where you are, and 20, 30 minutes from now, that storm can be right overhead and howling.
Gus says the idea is to be mindful, not fearful of the weather. He says to pay attention to the forecast and stay alert to any outlooks, watches, or warnings. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Farmers and ranchers who've been dealing with the fallout from Missouri River flooding also have been grappling with low commodity prices, trade tariffs, and high property taxes. In a business that requires hope and hard work, it's not easy for some operations to pay the bills, much less turn a profit. For Harvest Public Media, Jack Williams has more.
Flood water went right through our place here, and it took a gully right out of the middle of the place. Our water lines for our cattle are laid right there, and it took the water line right out of the ground.
As Tom Geisler trudges through the mud on his farm in Hupper in northeast Nebraska, all he can see is a big mess. He grows corn and soybeans on 1,000 acres in this small town, but high water from the March floods wrecked pretty much everything.
Never seen anything like this before. Never even had water in the yard here before on the place. It's just been deep and devastating. And the one thing that was really bad was the ice cakes floating down and just cut everything to pieces.
Geisler has been at this for more than 40 years and is a fifth-generation farmer. It's in his blood, but things haven't been easy lately. With low prices for corn and soybeans, property taxes close to $100 an acre, and now this.
Always been up and downs ever since I've been farming. My dad always said the same thing, just watch out for the bad years and prepare for it because you're going to have them no matter what.
It's a common story in Nebraska and across the Midwest, especially in Iowa and Missouri. Net farm income has been down for a while, and many farmers and ranchers have more debt than they did a few years ago. Tina Barrett is the president of Lincoln-based Nebraska Farm Business and helps Midwest producers navigate tough financial times.
Everything's been kind of crazy for a while, and coming off of a significant price decline over the last few years and adjusting to that, now we're dealing with the flooding and significant areas of Nebraska. And all of those things are kind of coming into play and creating an unknown for 2019 that we haven't seen in a while.
Those unknowns can be stressful on farmers and ranchers who have built their lives around their crops and livestock.
This last year, we set 4 new all-time monthly highs for the most new first-time high-stress phone callers.
John Hansen is the president of the Nebraska Farmers Union and has been part of the Rural Response Hotline since it started in 1984. Farmers and ranchers can call the number for mental health resources and other assistance during tough times. Hansen says many ag producers in a hole financially have a hard time admitting they're failing.
It's their identity. It's their inheritance. It's their legacy. It's all of these things in addition to being a high-risk, capital-intensive, low-margin business.
Across the Midwest, farm bankruptcies jumped 19% last year. Creighton University economist Ernie Goss says many farmers entered this downturn in a pretty good place financially after a run of high commodity prices a few years ago. And he says there will always be a demand for their products, despite the recent slowdown.
There's one thing we all need, and that's food, and that's globally. It doesn't matter if you're in China, India, France, or Germany, wherever.
Steve Nelson, the president of the Nebraska Farm Bureau, says there are reasons to feel optimistic, but
it could be that it'll take a year or two before they understand that they can't come back from this kind of loss.
Back at Tom Geisler's farm, he's fixing and saving what he can. It's a big mess, but he's optimistic.
Yeah, you just have to be resilient and keep going, and hopefully it'll work out for us this year. At least something. Hopefully we'll have a good crop, but nobody knows that except God. So,
surrounded by a landscape he hardly recognizes, he pauses to look around a scene of mud and destruction.
Someday, hopefully, you can get it back to the way it was. It's going to be a while.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Jack Williams.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, Bill Thomas joins us to talk about a new exhibit at the North Dakota Museum of Art.
Prairie Public is proud to present the live storytelling event, The Moth, November 14th at the Fargo Theater. Tickets available May 3rd at 10 a.m. in person at Tickets 300 or online at jadepresents.com.
Hello, I'm Errol Pepcorn. You might think that because I'm the voice of Dakota Datebook that I love history. Well, I do. But I also love the blues. I love playing the blues on my harmonica. And I love hearing the blues on Mike Olson's Saturday Evening Blues Cruise here on Prairie Public. There's nothing like dragging Broadway on a nice Saturday night and cranking up the blues loud on the radio. A blues show that can give you a lift. The Saturday Evening Blues Cruise, 9 p.m., 8 Mountain Time on Prairie Public.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for joining us on Main Street across the state of North Dakota this time of day. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Bill Thomas. He's the director of radio for Prairie Public. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Sure.
You were in Grand Forks recently at the North Dakota Museum of Art for an exhibit, one that caught your attention.
Yeah, it's called Power Empower, and it's all material that's from the museum's permanent collection. So they dug back into the warehouse, you know, and I just love these kind of variegated shows that have all sorts of different work from different people, but around a theme. And power can be talking about political power or natural power, people against religion, people against nature, people are part of nature, people against different industries, people against other people. So that's the theme, is power and empowerment. It's just a whole big range of works. And when I got there, I was actually there the day the exhibit was to open, and I got there, they were just putting the finishing touches on the installation. And I got to talk to Matt Wallace, who's the deputy director of the museum, and he talked just about some of the challenges of setting this show up.
Well, I think one of the best things about this is that we have a network of very skilled volunteers that come in consistently throughout the year. One's a retired farmer, a couple art students who are very familiar with installation, but then also a staff that often drops whatever they're doing and comes upstairs and sort of shifts focus for a week until we get this done, because a project like this is enormous. As you see, there's sculptures that you said weigh a couple ton. That takes the hands of many to try and figure out how the best way to elevate and get each piece into place as we go along. And I think we're just fortunate to have a good crew here.
It used to be sculptures and paintings. You hang them, you set them up. Now you've got, like, electronic issues to deal with.
Yeah, you know, and this is how it's progressing, but it's very, very difficult to troubleshoot sometimes. And I think that's, again, where we're fortunate in that the crew that we have here at the museum, they're kind of, you know, what do they say, the jack of all trades? They have people who are very skilled in electronics, and if we can't figure it out, you know, we know someone in town who's very good at that, and then we can bring that person in. And the people here are very generous to the museum. They, you know, very rarely do we get a bill when we need some sort of expertise brought in for something like this. And today was an example of that, where we had to bring in a technical consultant to work on a video piece for us. And gentleman spent about 3 hours here this morning helping us get the bugs out of that piece and getting it ready for the opening.
It is all going to be ready, right?
It will be ready. You know, doors open at 5:30, but we may put some labels on the wall at 5:15. But people will come in indoor thinking that it's been this way for a week.
So hanging the show is one thing, and of course there's curating it too, coming up with the idea.
Right, right. Well, and I asked Laurel about that, Laurel Reuter, and you'll hear in a moment her response to my question. But I just have to say, if you go look at it, it despite how different all the works are in it from each other, it does hang together. And it's as I've mentioned, I like shows that have a lot of different artists and a lot of different media. And but I asked Laurel exactly that question. I said, "What was the genesis of this show?"
The genesis was I didn't have any money. And so I thought, okay, let's dig into our collection. And I started thinking about it, and we had some very big, important work that we don't show very often. And then gradually I realized it was all about power of some kind or another. And I and the staff, we dug deeper. And then I began to think about, but we're missing several sections because it dates back 50 years. And a friend was in a studio in New York of David Opdyke, and he saw this little postcard, and it was our Capitol building with this great big oil pipe coming out of it flowing into another building. And the friend said, "Have you showed this to Laurel?" And he said, "No." He said, "You got to send it to her." Well, of course, as soon as I saw it, I wanted the whole installation, which he was just finishing. And so he was here this week installing 529 postcards. And it's all about what we humans are doing to our own environment. So that was the beginning. And then I knew I needed to expand. And so we found another 3-4 artists who were working today. And we had a hole in it yesterday when we were finishing up. So went back into the collection and found more good work. So I think it also traces the history of what I've cared about over the years. And much of it is in our collection, which is quite wonderful.
These animations are very evocative and very colorful and active.
Yeah, game technology was a big influencer of what he used in making them. And sometimes they're funny, which is nice. But as you said earlier, there are other works that are very subtle. For instance, there's a confessional, the Catholic Church, the individual's relationship with God is controversial within various Christian religions, and it's very soft and very subtle. It's a beautiful piece of artwork. So there are several works like that that I think are very strong.
And these represent works that you've acquired over the years. How big is the collection of the North Dakota Museum of Art?
Oh, it's so big, if we don't find permanent collection storage soon, I'm going to have to quit. There's so much wonderful work. And much of it is gifts. We don't have big money. And often it'll be artists who show here. There's a huge altarpiece that was created in 91 by a South African artist, and I had shown her here. And when and it was for the Cathedral of St. John the Divine Thanksgiving service. After it closed there, she didn't know what to do with it because it was so expensive to ship back to South Africa. It weighs 2 tons or something. And so we said, well, I said, well, why don't we store it for you until you figure out what to do? Storage became 2 decades. And finally, she just said, I'm just going to give it to you. And I said, I'm just going to take it. It's way too big for us, but it's really quite splendid.
Well, it works well as it's installed for this show.
Mm-hmm. One side is the side of the rich, the symbols of the rich. Gold conglomerate from the mines and cattle hides and all those symbols. But one of the 12 panels was done by Indian students up at Turtle Mountain. And then on the back side of all of it, all 12 panels are symbols of the poor. And so on the North Dakota side, we have commodity tins and commodity packaging, which was very prevalent during the 50s and 60s.
So there's a Turtle Mountain connection, and there's a video installation that has images from Spirit Lake. But there's a big part of the show that has to do with Standing Rock.
Yeah, we have a second or another exhibition upstairs of the photographer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, who made multiple trips to Standing Rock. And he could be part Asian, but he's at least a quarter American Indian. He's a very good photographer, so we have a whole show of his work. We also have a large installation by Will MacLean from Scotland, and it's about the loss of Gaelic. And how English has overpowered many of the languages of the world. We worry that it will overpower all of them soon.
So finally, of course, you've talked to somebody who's hanging the show, the person who curated the show, and now it's time to talk to an artist, right?
Yeah, Lamar Peterson. He's an African-American artist. He's from the Twin Cities. His work is in the show. And again, it's a show with a whole bunch of different artists from the archives and the vaults and the warehouses of the North Dakota Museum of Art. And Lamar had some thoughts about being in the show and just his own work. It was really interesting to talk to him about that, having looked at his work that's in the show. And it's always fascinating to hear an artist and what they're thinking. It's not always what you expect about the work that they produce and who's going to look at it and what they hope people will take away from it.
I have actually 4 pieces. Three fairly large-scale oil paintings on canvas, and then 1 work on paper.
And so, you know, when Laurel talked to you about the show, how did she characterize it for you?
Well, she characterized it as being about power. I think that's something that runs true to my work, something I think about in my own practice, and probably majority of my figures are of African-American descent, so... In a sense, thinking about my work in relationship to the ideas of power, it just kind of made sense and worked.
You have human figures, right? Is that mostly what you...
Mostly men, usually, and they kind of stand as self-portraits. Not exactly... I don't think of my work as representing the African-Americans as a whole. It's more about self-portraiture and my views on the world and my day-to-day experiences.
So your use of color and line and expression and metaphorical or surrealistic touches in the work, can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. The color is a way to kind of bring the viewer in. I love bright color. I think it's a great way to set the scene. I'm originally from Florida. The light in Florida is very different. There's a lot of color, a lot of green grass and blue skies. So that often is depicted in my artwork. As far as the social surrealism, the social aspects of the work, it's been an evolution over time. It started out as being a commentary on the idea of the American dream in the United States. And since then, it's kind of morphed and changed into being more interlooking and thinking about my own take about the world and being an African-American world man in this world and then living in the United States.
What kind of reactions have you had to your work? How have people taken your work?
People, I think the work has been well received. People really enjoy the color, and generally there's often people smiling or engaging with the viewer, often looking directly at the viewer. But then they hopefully notice something a little darker below the surface, more serious. So I kind of like this play between, you know, the happy-go-lucky feeling of the work, and then something off a bit. Something more sinister and strange.
Yeah, when people hear the theme of the exhibit is power, empower, and it's about, and you see the images that are used to publicize the exhibit and so on, there's an expectation, I think, of kind of tension and so on. And your work doesn't just like, I mean, some of the works explode with tension and conflict that are in this show. Your work is not like that, though.
Yeah, for me, I was thinking more about empowerment, not necessarily, you know, more thinking about within. And a lot of my characters, like I created one small painting called The Poet, and I think poets have a lot of powerful abilities to change the world through their spoken art form. Poetry can change minds. And as well as the written word, but, you know, hip-hop artists, musicians that use poetry to connect with people and hopefully, you know, make our world better.
I'm curious if you've had a chance to look around the show.
I have, just now. I'm in the process, actually. I'm currently upstairs. I think the show looks fantastic. It's really, really diverse and different voices and... really some great painting in the show. I'm really excited about being part of it.
So you saw the show as it was going up, Power, Empower, at the North Dakota Museum of Art. How long is it there?
It is there through July. And I think, you know, a lot of people go through Grand Forks. Of course, if you live in Grand Forks, you can go see it anytime. But a lot of people pass through this time of year for one reason or another. And I think it is definitely worth a trip. There are some of the pieces are just huge and jump out at you. Some are subtle and quiet. It's really a great combination of fun show.
And the North Dakota Museum of Art is in an interesting place. It's right on the campus of the University of North Dakota.
Yeah, it's a little tucked away, but they've got signs. If you come down University Avenue, there's a sign that points you to it and will guide you around to it. And it is a museum. Every time I've gone there, I've always been glad I made the trouble to turn off the road and go to it.
And, of course, it has a little cafe as well.
It has a wonderful cafe. I had lunch there the day that I was up looking at this exhibit, and the food was really good. But the exhibit was especially interesting. And I should mention there's a couple other exhibits that are up at the same time. One of them is by a photographer from the Star Tribune in the Twin Cities who covered the Dakota Access Pipeline protest and the camp and the water protectors and all that stuff. So there are a lot of photos by him, blown up big, and that is a really interesting kind of a timeline slice in. And then there's another exhibit up there about from a Scottish artist about English and Gaelic and poetry and how one is overshadowing the other, but the other still has qualities that keep it going and so on. But the Power Empower exhibit, the postcard exhibit, the one that uses video game technology for three big panels of animation about the peopling of the Americas, and there's just so much in it.
All right. Bill Thomas, thanks for being with us today.
All right. Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
If you would just make these endless emails disappear, oh,
and show us how to fix the climate while you're here.
Ah, the weekends on Prairie Public. I mean, what could be better? Though you'd probably like to. Maybe you don't have the time to listen to Prairie Public for long periods during the week. You know, you have jobs and stuff. But you have the chance to dive deep and catch up on the weekends. Maybe you wake up to a little grammarian levity on Away With Words, or laugh at the absurdity of the week's news on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I bet you have a hard time running errands because you can't get out of the car with the immersive storytelling on This American Life and Radiolab that artfully paints the human experience with sounds and words. Perhaps it's Reveal's award-winning investigative reporting, the friendly, diverse, and youthful perspectives on It's Been a Minute, fun financial and entrepreneurial stories on Planet Money and How I Built This, or maybe Saturday evenings means hearing another stellar live guest on Live From Here. We could use your help in creating more driveway moments on the weekend for you. Become a sustaining member. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org. You can call 800-359-4145 or text the word support to 484848 and open the link we sent you. Thanks for loving the radio on the weekends and for supporting Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 2nd. The little towns of far northwestern North Dakota have seen ups and downs over the years, but a rich history nonetheless. Towns such as Zoll, Apam, Alamo, and Corinth along the Great Northern Railroad claimed decent populations in their early years, from 100 to 200 people a century ago to only a handful in some places today. It's a remote area of North Dakota, about 30 miles north of Williston, where even radio signals can be dodgy. Much of the local history is rooted in the old village of Cottonwood Lake, built in 1904 on the banks of the lake of the same name. It was renamed Alamo when the railroad came through and the town moved a bit to the west to be adjacent to the tracks. Nearby Corinth sprang up as a railroad town in 1916, as did Apam. Corinth was a thriving little village at first, with more than 100 people in 1920, but it declined over the following decades. Its elevator burned in 1966, and the post office closed on this date in 1969, with mail routed to nearby Alamo. Not long after, in 1970, the Lutheran Church closed. It was much later that Apam's post office closed, with mail also routed to Alamo. Though the towns have declined, memories still remain, along with shuttered brick schools and boarded-up buildings. Signposts in Apam indicate the purposes the building served. The area was featured in a photo essay by National Geographic called The Emptied Prairie. That spread frustrated state officials over its portrayal of North Dakota as abandoned, especially for people who still call that corner of North Dakota home. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll hear from Maddie Friedman, the award-winning author of Spies of No Country, a chronicle of the exploits of a ragtag unit assembled by the British as part of the battle for Israeli statehood during World War II. It's a unique, often overlooked view of a pivotal moment in history. And Tom Ezern will share a Plains Folk essay. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.